give us a talk on the topic which says cell phones in social transformation in Africa, insights from ongoing research in some African countries. Thank you.
I would like to start by saying that cell phones are like a baby to a family that has been too patient waiting for their first baby. They have invested a lot in having this baby, and therefore you have a lot of euphoria around the birth of this baby, and the baby gets endowed with a lot of expectations. So that's the first thing we recognize about cell phones. And especially in contexts like African contexts, where we are keen on achieving development and also keener at doing so at a very accelerated rate. So you can imagine how much hope has been invested in the cell phone. I'm pleased to say that our research somehow finds that that hope there's reason for that hope, but also it, as is typical with technologies, it says that hope is only possible if we are able to tame the technology. And the technology is not like a magic wand. It is research that seems to suggest that the cell phone as a technology and many other information and communication technologies can be very powerful instruments in human hands. But they are only as powerful as we enable them. So it's a sort of power, but power tamed, power domesticated by us and our needs, power informed by an overarching power, which is the human ability to shape these technologies to answer to various expectations. So in a way, they are quite weak. And it is something to celebrate, because if the technologies were anything but weak, then they could actually impose themselves on us and begin to dictate to us and force us into living a life shaped by machines. And it is still early days as far as this research is concerned. And what I'm sharing with you today is the Southern African component of our research, but it is much larger than Southern Africa, because we have countries in Central and West Africa and even as far up as Sudan that are part and parcel of this study. This is a scene in Bamenda in Cameroon where we always find excuse to go back to find out how people are using their cell phones. And the cell phone in many ways links up this place to lots of other places in the world, as far out in the world as the U.S., where you have Cameroonian diasporic communities, as far as the Middle East and China, and lots of them in Dubai, lots of them in Southern Africa, and all over the world. And there's that connection, that permanent connection, not only in terms of memories that people hold, and but also in how they remind one another that they are alive and kicking, and that relationships need to be kept active. If the statistics change very rapidly, but this is an indication of how mobile phones are being acquired and comparative image of what you get around the world. But statistics tell only one part of the story. In an African context, for example, where there's evidence of cultures of sociality and interconnections and interdependence of a significant nature, you have a phenomenon of single owner, multiple users. You just need to travel around African settings, like even casually around the airport, to find out how much a cell phone is worth more than just the individual that owns it in terms of actual usage. And you would go around and have telephone booths of various kinds, some circulating in the neighborhood where they implant a phone, and lots of people can receive calls from there and make calls using a single phone. So if one were to use ownership of a phone as an indication of usage, you might miss out on the extended and extensive usage of cell phones, even by those who do not own it. And so there's a phenomenon of single owner, multiple users, a very characteristic of African settings. And investors like MTN and all the others that invest internationally have realized that there's a lot more money to be made, say, within an African context, with that particular logic, than you would make in other contexts, say Germany or the US, where you can equate a cell phone to an individual and you can determine usage by the number of cell phones only. That gives you a sort of mapping of mobile or cell phone coverage on the continent. And it is growing and changing very rapidly. Our research has tended to focus on a few questions, mostly concerned with what social transformations could be associated with new information and communication technologies, and in this particular instance, the cell phone. And I use the word associated with because we cannot establish direct causal relationship, but we do find correlations between technologies present and the transformed social relations. We are also interested in migrant communities, especially those who move. You know, for long, mobility in African settings has never really been studied as something positive, something to be appreciated on its own terms, but often is studied as a pathology. When an African person moves or crosses borders, you find out why is it happening that they are crossing borders when they should stay fixed. So the cell phone would help us to, and these technologies, to understand just how they cross borders, but also how those within borders relate to them and how this transpires in the relationships that they try to maintain with both localities, host community and community of origin. Amongst our key questions are some of those. And we are particularly interested in how the cell phone mitigates distance amongst mobile communities. But you'll be very interested in some of our findings that the cell phone in many ways actually enhances that distance or enhances the distance. Because when mitigation of distance entails relatives and extended families trying to prey on almost every single rand you have earned in South Africa, you might want to begin to be creative how you use your cell phone and whom you allow to call you or not to call you as a way of keeping alive. some of the key concepts those, and we are particularly interested in the social appropriation of these technologies, and that is where the modesty of the cell phone comes from, in that we don't allow them to dictate to us as much as people would expect technologies to dictate. We tame them. We almost inoculate them against the possible overwhelming powers. It's the only way human beings can come to terms with machines. Because if you allow machines to relate to you on their own terms, they can actually turn your life upside down. And human beings have got that capacity, that agency to inoculate machines. And we call it, in this particular study, as social shaping or social appropriation of technologies. The methodologies that we have used in our studies are very obvious, as you know. If you don't understand any of them, you could ask questions when it comes to discussion. Some of the students, and there are only some of the students, and those based in Southern Africa, that are part of this study are listed, as you can see on the slide. And a lot more of them come from other countries like Niger, Chad, Senegal, and Cameroon, in the rest of Africa. But those particularly interested in studying these technologies and the social appropriation in our context in South Africa are those you find on the board. One of them has already completed her master's, is the last one, who studied the silent frontiers, deaf people, and the social use of cell phones in Cape Town. And she did a fascinating study, and she reached the conclusion that although this technology is not normally meant for the deaf, the deaf have somehow developed a capacity to adopt and adapt what she calls the hearing baby. And they adopt and adapt this hearing baby to forge or consolidate links amongst themselves as deaf people with common needs, common expectations of the wider society, and so on. But they have adopted this hearing baby as, and adapted the baby as well, in order to maintain links with the world of the hearing, relatives and friends who are normally within the world of the hearing. And it's only in that way that they, as deaf people, can survive. Because they cannot survive by developing an exclusive idea of community, only deaf amongst themselves, because they are found wanting and they cannot use the cell phone as they would benefit from otherwise. But by being able to straddle the world of the hearing and the world of deaf, using this technology, they are able to harness the aspects of the technologies that are open to them, such as texting, and at the same time use voice through links with those in the hearing world to make their world complete. Actually, it's research that points to the importance of interdependence and a sort of what I would, for lack of a better term, call a domesticated agency in society, that you have to lean on one another if you are to forge ahead in terms of social transformation or simply staying alive. Some of the various findings that are beginning to come through are listed up as you can see, and I will let you take them in, and we can come back to some of them in terms of the questions. When it comes to questions and answers. But if you want to comment on some, ownership is not synonymous with usership. we have already alluded to that in one instance, but we could also allude to it in another instance, in that as cell phones become more and more commonplace, and almost everybody can have a phone, it doesn't necessarily imply that you are going to be able to feed your phone with airtime to be able to call. So you have cultures as call me back, and some threaten you on the phone, they ask for airtime from you, and you never know the airtime is finished until they send you an SMS asking for more. And if you are the boyfriend or the sugar daddy or whatever you might call sugar mommy, you begin to feel very cross. What are you using my airtime for? And that is... It facilitates contact over distances and maintenance of ties. That is obvious. It is a status symbol. And just the sheer number of cell phones that people have is an identity marker, of cell phone numbers, sorry. And if you want to know how connected someone is, and I almost joke, if you want to know whether someone is African or non-African, and if they are not a journalist who accumulate numbers because of their work, just look at the amount of numbers in their cell phones. You will be able to determine somebody's identity just at the number of cell phone numbers they accumulate. Just try. Go anywhere and find out. Try out the exercise, and we can discuss. There are also, like in Sudan, we have a case of women often being relegated to the private sphere, to the home, and to being veiled and so on. But the cell phone has proved remarkable in unveiling them, even within their veils. Because one of our students worked on SMS messaging, a book titled Message in a Mobile, or Text in a Mobile, where she studied young women in the University of Khartoum, being able to share poetry amongst themselves and composed texts and share them that ordinarily would be frowned upon by those in the wider society who police society or who serves as gendarmes about human the identity of women and the possibilities that come their way. And they are able to bypass such mechanisms of control thanks to the creative appropriation of the cell phone. More results. It's almost as if the old man who is from Mali is contemplating whether he can do it, whether to do it by foot or by cell phone. And of course, the answer is obvious. The cell phone plays an interesting role in not only in the production of conflict, but also in conflict resolution, both in the public and private spheres. So it is a gadget around which you have tensions and quarrels and even strained relations amongst intimate circles. Just as you can use them in case of politicians who want to stay in power despite the lack of popularity, to rig elections in very creative ways, and basically, and even down to churches where pastors use cell phones to remind their congregations towards month end that payment of tithes is a very important obligation to God, and so on. So you'd have a pastor with about six or seven cell phones in Botswana, just waiting for the moment pay time, because it's important. If you allow the congregation 2 or 3 days of grace, it might be too late for you to harvest in the name of God. I try to arrange our results around possible themes, mobility and change in the lives of families, and cell phone and multiple allegiances, their role in redefinition and adjustment of what they tell us about our capacity to redefine and adjust technologies, and cell phones and social cohesion. Still some more themes. This is the conclusion which we started with as an abstract. And finally, you have my mother-in-law trying to find out when the remittances are coming in. So I'm open to... I decided to leave 30 minutes for questions and discussions and so on.
Okay, thank you, Professor Nyong'o, for such a very fabulous job. I know my cell phone was having a problem. It was not taking messages, but... immediately started to speak, all the messages were just coming in. So we have, I think, 30 minutes or so for questions. Just to remind the audience that this talk forms part of the Africa Day, where we are celebrating Africa. But I think this talk is very relevant as we are trying to look at the role of technology. You know, two perspectives, like you said, whether technology or cell phones are really taming us as Africans, or we are really shaping them. So I think this is a very fascinating issue that you can ask whatever question, he will answer that. Okay, can we see the hands? Okay, just I think maybe I don't know whether you want, I can take a few and then
yeah,
you answer
exactly.
That. Okay.
You mentioned at the beginning sort of the anticipation and expectancy around cell phone technology and development, sort of the keenness of the question to development both at a rapid rate. And it seems like it's getting to be more understood how individuals are using cell phones, how family networks or communities are using their cell phones. But I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit towards how development initiatives are using cell phones. In particular, I'm looking at mobile health. And one of the big criticisms is that they never really make it out of their pilot phase, and so you have all this information on a small scale, but whether or not that can make a large scale difference is still unknown.
Can we take maybe another one more question or two? Yeah.
Let me start with the second. I prefer to talk of cultures of conviviality that emphasize interdependence and sharing or whatever, and that tend to be very measured about notions of individual success in a context where lives are lived in associations or in relationships with others. And your success can only make sense to the extent that you are generous with it. I prefer that notion of cultures of conviviality, and anybody can come and claim it. They are not the monopoly of any given group. Even if at some point in history you might think that some groups demonstrated more than others at for various reasons, historical and so on. But I prefer to leave it at that general level, and people can subscribe to it as they see fit. But I do know also that there's a way in which hardship has a way of taming an exaggerated sense of doing it alone as an individual. And you can see it from working class families in Europe and elsewhere, where you cannot afford to leave others behind with your sense of success. There's always a joke that in those sort of communities, it's difficult to come by Bill Gates or the founder of Facebook, is it Zuckerberg? Yes. Because when they start celebrating their millions, this is someone who says, "Congratulations, you've made it," to the individual. Those who believe that such success is very dangerous would qualify that congratulatory message by saying, "Congratulations, you've made it to the starting point." Because it's only when you demonstrate your ability to include others in your success, which Bill Gates does very well through his philanthropic work, only then do you begin to be visible beyond the narrow circles of individual success. So I would think you were right, and the person was also right, to limit this culture to Africa is to impoverish the rest of the world, because people try very much to harness success. If you wanted to limit success only to the individual, I would never leave my inheritance to my children or to whoever I like. I would leave it to my cat or my dog and say, "Go and fend for yourself." So there's always an element of succeeding with, rather than simply succeeding as an individual. But the second question, the first question is about development initiatives. I think what this study does, by focusing on individuals and the networks that they create, is to begin to work towards certain theories of appropriation of cell phones or technologies in general towards more collective interests or ends. Because there's a tendency for those who are more interested in harnessing for development purposes, even before they have understood the adoption of the technology in all its nuances and different social and political or economic contexts, there's a tendency to overly celebrate the technology, almost to impose the technology on the very social context that you are trying to assist. And therefore, you become deaf to the needs, and you become deaf to a certain nuanced idea of a complex idea of their situation and what they really need to be able to develop. And there's a certain evangelical commitment to development when people think that they have what it takes to develop. And you may actually, it might actually turn out being self-defeating than just being humble enough to understand this is a technology, we believe it can be very powerful just as it can be very modest in its contributions. It is important to see and relate to it in a given context. And once you do that, you would get it right. In the study by Murder on deaf in Cape Town, She examined some of those technologies because she was in the field at the same time with a young man from Holland who was trying to develop a technology for the deaf. But the social context was not very much built into to this initiative. And those whom she interviewed or related to in her overall ethnographic approach were able to tell her how uncomfortable they felt with the assumptions that this technological expert was making, well-meaning as he might have been. Yeah.
Another question?
Well, I would like to take you back to your intro where you did mention that so much hope is invested in mobile phone and that used an analogy of an expectant mother, which is a very very profound way of thinking of someone's talk, and I really like that. My question is about the role of education, higher education, and social transformation. And there's no question that the mobile phone has become very prevalent in Africa, and that the uptake of this technology is really unquestionable. However, we continue to see how that the mobile phone is so demonized in education, especially in schools. And we see mobile phones being so demonized and banned in schools. We continue seeing that kind of trend. And I'm quite worried about the role of education. Social transformation. I'm not quite sure as to when, and in your own view, when do you really see an interface between education playing an important role in driving social transformation, social change, with this powerful device which is there, when there is this continuation in demonizing the technology itself? I mean, at which point do you really see these talking to each other? What's your comment?
Yeah. I do think that, yes, the cell phone is suffering the fate of most other technologies. If you follow the history of adoption of technologies, even let's limit ourselves only to technologies of information and communication, you would notice about a certain discourse around these technologies always, they are so powerful that if we don't keep them in check, they could derail societies and entire generations. There's that assumption that we make about the powers of these technologies, almost as if they act on their own without human agency. And it is precisely that particular logic that leads us to see technology or cell phones in this case in higher education more as a problem. And because we see it as a problem, we do not invest adequately in terms of how could we harness this technology to begin to assist education rather than simply be seen as a threat by those who are in charge of educating others. So again, we need to demystify the technology. And in your case, we need to demonize to let it know that real power rests with us as social actors and not with these technologies. There's no way a cell phone, however powerful it is, will jump upon you, switch itself on, and impose a message on you without you acting. No way at all. I'm yet to see. So its agency, however compelling, is quite within our limits, our ability to tame. So I think the challenge is then in the rest of society to move beyond this scaremongering approach and this idea of an all-powerful technology, and begin to see how to cultivate relationships between the technology and our expectations of social transformation. If we do that, it could achieve quite a lot. It's a question of policy. It's a question of us in higher education knowing better about technologies and knowing that at the end of the day, it's what we make of them. And that's where the power lies, I think. Not very convincing. Yes, I think in some countries, mostly West African countries, I have seen lots of phones with dual SIM cards. Dual SIMs, one phone that can take two SIM cards, and that has come mostly from China and transported through Dubai and the rest, and they're very cheap and affordable. They have come to answer a need for people, by people to shop around different networks, cell phone networks, because the networks are not reliable in terms of economically, one might cost or more than the other, and they can be able to play against it. Or network coverage is not extensive. And sometimes you might have Orange in one, better than MTN, and MTN in the other. So if you have two networks, you guarantee your possibilities of coverage. It could also be as a way of entertaining social relations in a complex way that cell phone providers with one SIM card do not adequately provide for. So if you are someone who wants to keep one relationship from getting in contact with the other, and you don't want to mess up your life, then you keep them apart like that from different cell phones. There is also increasingly perhaps given an exaggerated sense of self-importance where people do not want any moment when they cannot be reached. Even when they are making one phone call, the other comes, they should be able to answer both at the same time. And you do have some fascinating programs in Nigerian films. I don't know how many people here watch Nigerian home entertainment movies, but some of them are quite good. There's one around the cell phone and network. Someone who literally goes mad because he's running around trying to get network until his family takes him to the psychiatrist and said, our husband is mad, our father is mad. So in a way, I do think that although the cell phone companies have a way of trying to sell things and their products, people increasingly, when they can afford to, pick and choose accordingly to suit their own needs, and they do that quite creatively. I was joking with friends the other day about this a Vodacom advert, night shift. It ends with the words, "Are you free or are you dumb?" And this guy who wants to sell the possibility of them telephoning or calling between 12 and 5 a.m., 12 at night and 5 a.m., to these guys who are on night shift, is a logic that defies the sense of sociality. Because very few people, apart from them working night shift, are up at night. So the families are there sleeping, and you don't want to wake them up to be tortured just as you are being tortured to earn a living. And so, yet, and you do see, they are trying to sell that line, a very impossible existence to anyone else. And little wonder the words, they play on the idea of freedom. Are you free or are you dumb? Because you need to be dumb to imagine that you're working and every other person is awake and listening and ready to entertain a conversation with you. So there's some amount of, when they have the possibility to relate to these providers on their own terms. But where you have them as monopolies and so on, they can be quite overbearing. I don't know if...
Another question? Okay, Chef.
Professor, you had a slide that just had the words gender and age on it. Did you manage to just talk about things at the top of the slide? But clearly, it suggested that there were findings in relation to gender and age, and I'd be quite interested to hear what they were, because I think the research that I've picked up around Africa is that issues around gender and technology are quite contradictory and often quite country-specific, so I wasn't sure.
Yes. I didn't want today to talk about that, but in terms of country-specific terms, I tried to capture some of these gender and age dynamics in the novel he called, and everybody chuckled, Married But Available. And it is the main character in the book is a PhD student who is... comes to a country in West Africa to do research on sex, power, and consumerism in Africa. And one of the things she gets involved in after losing her cell phone is to make up for it by having been forced to buy a new cell phone because the taxi driver whose taxi she mistakenly left her phone wouldn't answer when she calls for her phone. And she starts research on cell phone use, the differences between male and female and so on, which is actually research that we did, and I tried to communicate it to the wider world through a novel and so on. You'd find that lots of men, when they comment on women and the relationship to the cell phone, offer you a lot of food for thought and about social relations. There's this sense, at least in Cameroon, Nigeria, and Senegal, that women would try very hard to avoid buying airtime for their phone, and they would want those who are close to them as men to nourish their phones, and there's also the sense that when they have airtime, they use it purposefully in a very creative ways to achieve ends, whereas a man could waste away the same opportunities. There's that dimension. There's also the dimension of cell phones as status symbols. And there's a sense in some circles that women would like to display the cute phones. Who would go for cuter phones? There used to be a phone in Cameroon, Motorola that had an antenna. Everybody started calling it bricks, it's like a brick. And there was a joke that you would, if you mistakenly forgot it somewhere, 2 years later you could come back and still find it. Nobody would touch it. And of course, it's men who would have such bricks. And they would ask, what are you doing with this brick? And they could judge you whether you are generous or you are tight-fisted. And in Cameroon, they talk about it, those men who are tight-fisted are like Japanese handbrakes. Yeah, difficult to put down and so on. Anyway, but basically, there are such things which, and again, the idea of the ringtone. The ringtone, similarly, ringtones seem to a mark of character, and sometimes it takes gender lines. And young people are much more into using their phones for various things like music, downloadables, and of various kinds, and connections with. At first, it used to be difficult to have all these distinctive usages, because the memory of the phone was very, very little. But now, with memory cards of various kinds, people have greater opportunity to express their identities much more without the concern that they will run out of space. So, yeah.
Any more questions?
Oh yeah, definitely. I did talk about cell phones and its involvement in production of conflicts, just as in conflict maintenance. And of course, these they offer you. That's why we talk about cell phones as enablers. Hmm? If you are a compulsive harasser of others for sexual purposes, the cell phone offers you an opportunity to harass at an accelerated rate. If you are a dictator, the cell phone offers you an opportunity to dictate at an accelerated rate. If you are a pastor, so on and so forth, and student, so it just enables, it increases speed of what you are doing, but it doesn't dictate to you what you do. It doesn't change yourself, like your humanity. It's still you. If you are a thief, you can gang up with a lot more thieves and waylay people who are fresh from the bank and communicate the details to whoever is far away where they are driving to. So they, when they come, they get ambushed and whatever they have had taken away from them. I think it's very useful, even as we know that cell phones have the potential to transform social life, to see them more as enablers. So in that sense, you don't have a one-dimensional all-positive view or a one-dimensional all-negative view, but you have a nuanced and context-specific understanding of these technologies here. Yeah.
The shared use of cell phones, but then you also spoke a lot about identity and people using phones with things like ringtones and special and becoming really part of who they are. So how does that dynamic work? Is it just a matter of need and capacity? People can't afford their own cell phones, or do people use cell phones, like your own phone for some things and then shared phones for other things? What will the search mean about that?
No, I think when you have your own phone, then you can shape it to reflect your identity. Because if it's a shared phone, then there's no way in which you can have that intimate encounter or relationship with it to be able to shape it as you would like to. And but clearly, when people do have their own phones, at first we used to have very homogeneous ringtones because we still went to the phone to get what they offered us. But these days, with more storage capacity, it is difficult to find, increasingly difficult to find, whether you are in a bus or in a plane or in a marketplace, the same ringtone. You'd find one screaming passages from the Quran in this set, the others are the Bible, and the one singing Lady Gaga, and so on. So it's all sorts of a cacophony of possibilities, thanks to the enhanced capacity, and I think it is a statement about identity, or a statement about tolerance. Because some of those ringtones are put into your phone by your children, playing with your phone. But it also indicates that you are a tolerant mom or a tolerant dad, that you allow your children to be part of your life. And so, yeah.
Francis?
Yeah.
I have a question, a curiosity about the market here. Because I really don't understand why MTN or Vodafone, they don't offer cheaper plans for people to subscribe to one of them, or either to two of them, as you were saying.
Yeah.
Because in Brazil, some people, they have two SIM cards, they have two plans, they subscribe to two different companies, and they say, I am MTN, what are you? So, I am Vodafone, what are you? And they call people from the same company, so it's a, the company becomes part of their relationship.
Mm.
And here, from what I can see, it's mainly on buying airtime and this commodity as a kind of a bridge between people, as you were saying, you buy me some airtime. And so I really don't understand the companies, how MTN and how Vodafone, they work and they think about the consumers, because they act in a very different way from what people do in their real lives. So.
Yeah. I think the idea of subscription is one which is possible mostly for people with a certain who are certain about their salary, their wages, mm-hmm. and so on. So you would find that very few people subscribe.
Mm-hmm.
Even in South Africa, you'd see the bulk of people who can hardly make ends meet in a way that is predictable would go for pay as you go,
mm-hmm.
just buy the airtime and so on. It could also be as a deliberate move by people to manage their consumption and again, pay as you go, in many ways, is an easy way of earning money, which actually you pre-finance the companies, basically, yes, by buying. That's why they cannot afford to lose this particular form of clientele, because you pre-finance and they dictate how if you make a call, whether they're going to measure consumption by seconds, which has implications for cost, or by minutes, and so on and so forth. So it's a real black forest of kinds where they can just go and do as they like, and as long as it exists, they would I think many of these companies would actually prefer it to subscription in any formal sense, yeah. And it seems like that's very lucrative in around the continent. Yeah.
I think this was our last question. I see students standing outside here, so we have run out of time. You can still take some questions as Professor Nyamjo is leaving. Thank you very much for giving this a very interesting presentation. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you.
I hope it wasn't too disappointing.